First of all, they make it clear that Buddhism teaches a plurality of worlds, not just one world, but an infinity of worlds. It teaches also that these worlds are inhabited, some of these worlds at least are inhabited, by other intelligent beings. And it teaches too that these worlds and these other intelligent beings are not outside the scope of Buddhism, of the way to enlightenment, either theoretically or practically. In this connection, I recollect that some years ago there arose a dispute among some German Catholic theologians. You probably know that German Catholic theologians are generally in the forefront of Catholic theological thinking. And the question which arose was this: suppose, as a result of the discoveries of modern science, we find that other worlds are inhabited. Suppose we find intelligent beings on Mars, or on Venus, or even on the Moon. Then, the question which arises, they said, is, does the Christian scheme of redemption apply to those beings? Did Christ die for them? Or did he die only for the inhabitants of this earth? This was a question much discussed and much canvassed among these German Catholic theologians some years ago. An opinion was, as it usually is in theological circles, divided. Some said, no, Christ's salvation, Christ's saving death, is for the benefit of the beings of this earth only. Others said, no, it's for the benefit of all sentient beings, as we would say, whatsoever. So there was a division. But we may say, there's no such division in Buddhism. So far as Buddhism is concerned, the question was settled long ago. Settled, in fact, from the very beginning. And it's on this account, partly, that we say that Buddhism is a universal teaching in the fullest sense, a teaching applicable to all intelligent beings at any time, whether now or 10 million years ago or 10 million, 100 years hence, in any part of the universe, in this galactic system or in any other imaginable galactic system, is applicable at all times and in all places, everywhere. And this fact is brought out very clearly, not to say strongly, in some of the Mahayana sutras. Especially, we may say, the Siddharma Pundarika Sutra, or White Lotus of the True Teaching, often called simply the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra, we may say quite definitely, is the grandest of all the Mahayana sutras. Others may be more profound in their teaching, more subtle, but the Siddharma Pundarika, the Lotus Sutra, is certainly the grandest, the most awe-inspiring, the most colourful, the most impressive, the most dramatic. We might even go so far as to say that it's perhaps the grandest of all the spiritual documents of mankind. But we've no time this evening to say very much about it. I'll just refer to a few passages relevant to our present theme. But first of all, let me quote Sutil, one of the translators of the Lotus Sutra, on the Lotus Sutra as a whole. Sutil says, "From the first chapter, we find the Lotus Sutra to be unique in the world of religious literature." He was, by the way, a Christian missionary in China. "A magnificent apocalyptic. It presents a spiritual drama of the highest order, with the universe as its stage, eternity as its period, and Buddhas, gods, men, devils, as the dramatis personae. From the most distant worlds and from past eons, the eternal Buddhas throng the stage to hear the mighty Buddha proclaim his ancient and eternal truth. Bodhisattvas flock to his feet, gods from the heavens, men from all quarters of the earth, the tortured from the deepest hells. The demons themselves crowd to hear the tones of the Glorious One." So this is how Sutil describes the Lotus Sutra as a whole. The scene of the sutra, the venue of the sutra, is the Vulture Peak, that great rocky crag overlooking Rajagriha. I've stood there myself in the evening time, looking out over the valley, and certainly a very peaceful, a very solitary, a very sublime spot it still is. And it was the scene, it was the venue of many discourses given by the Buddha, of many teachings given to his more intimate disciples. But in the Lotus Sutra, it isn't just a locality, isn't just an earthly mountain, isn't just a rocky crag. In the Lotus Sutra, it represents, it symbolizes the very summit of existence, the summit of conditioned existence itself. And as the sutra opens, as it unfolds, we see the Buddha surrounded by 12,000 arahants, 12,000 saints who realized nirvana for their own sake alone, by 80,000 bodhisattvas, besides tens of thousands of gods and other non-human beings with their followers. And on this occasion, seated on that spiritual vulture's peak, surrounded by this great congregation, the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, delivers a discourse. We're given the name of the discourse. I'm not going to mention it now. And at the conclusion of that discourse, as so often happens in the Mahayana Sutra, we're told that flowers rained down from the heavens and the whole universe shook. And then the Buddha, we are further told, entered into a very deep meditation. His eyes remained closed, the smile almost faded from his lips, and for a long, long time he remained immersed in deep meditation. And as he was in that state of deep, profound meditation, a ray of white light issued from between his eyebrows. And that ray of white light, we are told, lit up the entire universe, lit up the whole of conditioned existence, revealing in the infinitude of space in all directions innumerable world systems. And in each of these world systems so revealed by this white light shining from the Buddha's forehead, in each of these world systems was seen a Buddha teaching the Dharma to his disciples and a Bodhisattva sacrificing life, sacrificing limbs for the sake of supreme enlightenment, of supreme Buddhahood. And this great marvel, this great apocalyptic vision having taken place, the Buddha then reveals to the disciples, to the great assembly, a higher teaching, a more esoteric teaching, a profounder teaching than any ever given before. And what was the reaction? Some of the disciples were able to accept it, but others were not. And those who were unable to accept this further teaching, this higher, this more esoteric teaching, simply walked out. A very significant episode. The others, those who remained, who could receive the teaching, they received from the Buddha what is called a prediction. I've not mentioned this topic before, as far as I recollect, in any of the previous courses. A prediction follows upon the Bodhisattva's making of his vow, either in the form of the four great vows or any other form. And the vow, the Bodhisattva's vow, is made in the presence of a Buddha, a living Buddha. And this Buddha, in whose presence the Bodhisattva makes, or has made, his vow, then it tells that particular Bodhisattva what his name will be when he too becomes a Buddha, what the name of his Buddha field will be, and what his aeon, or his kalpa, will be called. And on this particular occasion, in this particular assembly, the one at which the Lotus Sutra was preached, Sariputra, for example, among others, is told that he will become a Buddha known as Lotus Radiance, that his Buddha field will be called the Pure, and that his aeon will be called the Great Jewel-Adorned Aeon.